Today's Taisho will be on case 23 in the Wuwongkang, the Wu Men Kwan. Case 23 is entitled Think Neither Good Nor Evil. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Monk Myo as far as Tai Yu Mountain. The ancestor, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the faith. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it away, take it now." Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge. Faltering and trembling, he cried out, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, give me your instruction." The ancestor said, "Think neither good nor evil." At this very moment, what is the original self of Monk Myo? At these words, Myo was directly illuminated. His whole body was covered with sweat. He wept and bowed, saying, "Besides the secret words and secret meanings you have just revealed to me, is there anything else deeper still?" The ancestor said, "What I have told you is no secret at all. When you look into your own true self, whatever is deepest is found right there." Myo said, "I was with the monks under Obi for many years, but could not realize my true self. But now, receiving your instruction, I know it is like a man drinking water and knowing whether it is cold or warm. My lay brother, you are now my teacher." The ancestor said, "If you say so, but let us both call Obi our teacher. Be mindful to treasure and hold fast what you have attained." Wumon's comment: the sixth ancestor was, so to speak, hurried into helping a man in an emergency, and he displayed a grandmotherly kindness. It is as though he peeled a fresh lychee, removed the seed, put it in your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. Momon's verse: you cannot describe it, you cannot picture it, you cannot admire it. Don't try to eat it raw. Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. I want to thank everybody for coming here on this beautiful spring day to practice Zen. Thank you so much for making that decision, that choice. When you get up in the morning on a Saturday morning and you come to sit, you're benefiting yourself, but you're not just benefiting yourself, you're benefiting everybody else who sits next to you. And even though you might be struggling, somebody next to you is probably struggling, and they look over at you and think, "Oh, she's sitting so still. I have to sit like that." And the other person is looking at the other one and saying, "Oh, he's sitting so still. I have to sit like that." See? And in this way, people help themselves wake up. So thank you so much. Just getting up and coming here is wonderful contribution. So this is a very famous story that involves the sixth ancestor, as he is called in this Taisho, in this koan. The sixth ancestor is Wei Neng. According to Zen tradition, Wei Neng's father was a bureaucrat, and his father died when he was just a little boy, and his mother was left penniless. So Wei Neng had to support his mother, who also had to work, and Wei Neng supported his mother as a woodcutter. So according to Zen tradition, Weining never had the chance to have a serious formal education. He worked as a woodcutter in order to support his mother, and that was his moral responsibility. At any rate, Weining grew up cutting wood and selling wood in the market, and one day he was taking a load of wood into the market, and he heard a monk reciting aloud verses from the Diamond Sutra. And basically, the verses from the Diamond Sutra were something like, there is no past mind, there is no present mind, there is no future mind, something to that effect. And when Weining heard those verses, which might not make much sense to us, but no past mind, how's that possible? No present mind, how's that possible? No future mind, how's that possible? We might just think, oh, that guy is a nut, But when Weining heard that, it deeply affected him. And he had a kensho, an opening experience, a great opening experience. But he still had to take care of his mother. And so he continued to take care of his mother until she died. And when she died, he was free to pursue, to investigate this deep insight he had had on the street. And so he went to, he heard about a Zen temple. And there was a teacher at the Zen temple who in Japanese is called Obai. Obai. And he went to the temple to practice Zen with Obai. But when he got there, he was not he was just a woodcutter. According to tradition, he was illiterate. And he wasn't an ordained monk, and there was nobody to vouch for him. When you become ordained, you're supposed to have a family member there who will vouch for you. And there's no one to vouch for him. He had no ties. So they put him to work in the kitchen. And all day long, Weining would thresh rice. So if you're a rice eater, as I am, I eat rice every day. And I eat brown rice, but actually in those days people much preferred white rice. And in order to get white rice, you have to take off all of the outer husk. And the way you would do this is they had different kinds of techniques, but one of the techniques was to lightly beat the rice with like a flail, like a little club or a little stick. And you could rake the rice or you could pound the rice. There was actually a machine where you would put the rice in a stone bowl. And then you would step on a board, and the board, as you depressed the board, a weight would come down and hit the rice, and then you'd let off the pressure, and then another step would push the board down, and the weight would hit the rice again. And if you pound the rice in this way, pretty soon all the husks come off, and then you take the husks away, and you can cook and serve the delicious white rice. So Weining's job was to sit on this basically little machine and pedal and pound the rice all day, day after day. And meanwhile, in the temple itself, everybody was eating the rice that Weining prepared, and they were cultivating awareness. They were practicing zazen, just as we did this morning. And what happened was that Obai began to get quite ill, and he realized that his time in this body was not long, and that he was approaching his end, and so he had to make preparations for his departure. and decide who would take over the temple after he passed away. And he had a student who was like his star pupil named Shen in Chinese. I'm not going to pronounce this properly, but Shen Xiu. And Shen Xiu was a very, very adept Zen practitioner and very sophisticated and intelligent person. And anyway, Shen Xiu was like the second in command of Obai. And people expected him to be Obai's successor. And one day Obai said, "Listen, you know, it's possible that I'm not going to be around much longer, and I want to identify who will take my place when I leave this body." And so he said, "I'd like everybody to write a poem that expresses your experience of enlightenment, of awakening. And then basically you can hang your poems on the pillars in the Dharma Hall, and I will read them and assess your understanding of enlightened mind." So you know, the story gets told in different ways. In some stories, everybody wrote a poem, and in some versions of the story, nobody wrote a poem except for Shen Xiu, because everybody thought Shen Xiu was such a deep practitioner of Zen that they really sort of deferred to him. So at any rate, Shen Xiu wrote a poem that goes something like this. He said, "The mind is like a mirror, and it gets covered by dust." See, and he said, "You have to keep cleaning the dust off the mirror so that it will shine brightly." Basically, that's the idea. This is an excellent poem. You know, if you don't do your zazen regularly, you know, you won't get anywhere with your practice. And you know, if you go for a week without doing your zazen, when you sit down on the cushion, you might notice that your consciousness is a little bit coarse. You know, a little bit less refined, less, it's like it's got, your mind has gotten sort of dirty in the week that passed. So, you know, all day long we're anxious, fearful, maybe angry, nervous, and this is like dust gathering on our mind, on the mirror of our mind. So, you know, if you do regular zazen, you know, especially if you do it in the evening or you do it in the morning, you get up and you clean your mirror and then you go through the day, and things happen to you that leave traces on your consciousness, both consciously and unconscious traces, right? But you get up and you sit down on the cushion and you clean your mirror. And, you know, I'm sure you've had this experience. That's why you're here this morning. You know, sometimes you get off the cushion and your mirror, your mind is just shining brightly, right? It's all the obstructions, or for some time the obstructions are gone and you feel the luminous nature of your mind, right? It's so refreshing, so delicious and wonderful. So, you know, when Shen Xiu wrote this poem basically saying, you know, the mind is like a mirror, we have to clean the dust and its radiant nature will shine forth, everybody was full of admiration. They thought, that's it exactly. You know, that's exactly what Zazen is all about. That's what we're doing. We're cleaning the mirror of the mind. And by the way, that's definitely true. That's definitely so. So, you know, for the monks in the temple, it looked like Shen Xiu's poem was a slam dunk. It's like, of course, that's it exactly. You know, I never knew what I was doing on the cushion, but I always knew I felt better when I got up. And Shen Xiu's poem really captures that aspect of Zen practice. If you don't clean the mirror, it gets dirty. Your mental habits definitely affect your access to that bright mind at the core of your consciousness. And so, you know, we try to live a life of ethical life, and we try to integrate Zazen into our lives so that that radiant clarity can manifest itself on occasion, when we get off the cushion or when we're on the cushion. And so, you know, seems like a perfect understanding of Zen. Meanwhile, back in the kitchen, Wei Neng is threshing rice, and he hears about this contest. He hears that Obai has decreed that everybody in the temple should write a poem expressing their state of mind. And remember that Wei Neng, this illiterate woodcutter, had heard somebody reciting lines from the Diamond Sutra. And as I said, to most people, those lines wouldn't make any sense. You know, there's in the past no mind, in the present there's no mind, in the future there's no mind. There's no past, present, or future. Another way to put it is there's no past, present, and future in awakened mind. See, that's another way to translate. Wei Neng had a deep enlightenment experience and was dwelling in this awareness. And when he heard about the contest, he said, he actually said to a monk working in the kitchen, "Well, I'd like to write a poem." And the monk just thought, right, you know, there's this hippie in the kitchen, right? Or this ragamuffin, this dirty little peasant in the kitchen, right? And he wants to write a poem. Well, and the monk could have said something, "Well, why don't you write the poem?" Sarcastically. And Wei Neng would have said, "Well, I can't write." So the monk thought, "Oh, brother." Now, the monk was obviously a kind person. He would have, an unkind person would have said, "Just get back to your rice, you know, shut up and get back to your rice." The monk was trying to practice the Buddha's way, so he was trying to be a compassionate person. And perhaps his heart was genuinely stirred at this request from somebody who had had so few breaks in life. Somebody who had basically had one bad break after another. Father dies, grows up in poverty, supports his mother till she dies, now all alone in the world, no skills, nothing to recommend him, no social graces, okay. So the monk thought, "Oh, this poor guy, okay, sure, I'll write your poem." And basically Wei Neng's poem was, there isn't really any mirror, and there isn't really any dust. From the beginning, not a thing. It's sort of the essence of the poem. And the monk didn't understand this, right? But he wrote it down. He went and put it on the pillar in the Dharma hall. So, you know, when the deadline had passed, it was time for Obai to inspect the poems. And as I say, in some versions of the story, there are lots of poems hanging from the pillars. But in some versions of the story, there's just two. There's Shen Xue's, and there's Wei Neng's. So Obai goes over, and he looks at Shen Xue's, and all the monks are watching, and he nods his head like, "Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. So good." But he doesn't say anything. He just nods, right? And then he goes over to the other pillar, where there's this poem that says, you know, there's no dust and there's no mind. From the beginning, not a thing is. He doesn't, no expression, no reaction. And then he just says, "Okay, I will announce the winner tomorrow." And he goes back into his quarters. So all the monks go about their work, but they're thinking, "Where did that crazy poem come from? You know, who knows? It's some. I hear it's that guy in the kitchen, you know, and then maybe they had a good laugh about it." So anyway, Wei Neng is spending his day pounding rice, threshing the rice, and he goes to sleep. Maybe in the kitchen he has a little bed, you know, and maybe the bed is a typical adobe, flat adobe surface with an oven underneath, a han. And he has some maybe some burlap bags on top for his mattress and for his covering. And anyway, he's going to sleep after a backbreaking day of pounding rice, and a monk comes down and says, "You know, Wei Neng, Obai, the abbot wants to see you. I don't ask me what it's about, right?" So anyway, Obai goes up into the abbot's quarters, and abbot says, "You know, basically, your poem shows that you have a deepest understanding of the Dharma." And he said, "You know, I am supposed to name my successor tomorrow. But if I name you as my successor, it's going to destroy this community, basically. Because, you know, there are people here who have been practicing for 25 years, and they have given this path all their efforts. They get up at 3 in the morning, they do zazen until 8, they have no personal time, they don't go on vacation, you know, and they have done this for 25 years. And you walk in here, you're an illiterate woodcutter, and you write this poem, and I turn the authority of the temple over to you, they'll go crazy, right? They'll leave, or they'll be totally baffled, and it will destroy this community that I've worked so hard to create." So, you know, he says, I'm kind of been in a bind about this. I haven't know what to do, because your insight is so profound." So he said, "You know, I'm giving you the robe and the bowl." And these were given these were brought by Bodhidharma, the Indian monk who brought Zen to China. And Bodhidharma's robe and bowl were passed down to each of the Zen ancestors. So each time somebody was about to die, they would give their robe and the bowl to the next Zen ancestor, the next person in the lineage who was identified to be the teacher. And Obai had received it from his teacher, and now he was supposed to give it to his successor. And so Obai says, "I'm giving you the robe and the bowl, but you have to leave here, or it will have an incredibly destructive effect on our community." And so Obai leaves at night. Wei Neng leaves at night, and Obai is left behind in his room. So Wei Neng leaves by night, and he goes into the woods, and he wanders far from this temple, and goes back, really goes to the south of China, goes into the south of China. Next day, you know, the abbot comes out and says, Obai comes out and says, I guess Shen Xiu is going to be leading our community, but he's not going to receive the robe and the bowl. I'm just naming him as the new abbot." And everybody's baffled by that. Like, what the hell? You know, he's supposed to get the robe and the bowl. And Obai says, "Look, I don't want to talk about it. I've made my decision. Believe me, it's the best thing for everybody. Shen Xiu is highly qualified, and that's the end of it." But the monks can't put it down, right? It's like, where's the robe and the bowl? Why isn't he giving him the robe and the bowl? So one of the monks at the temple in Chinese, his name is sometimes called Wei Meng, Wei Meng, M-E-N-G, Wei Meng, or Wang, Wei Meng, or Wei Shun, sometimes Wei Shun. Here he is called, in Japanese, he is called Myo. So at any rate, Monk Myo was a general. He had been a high-ranking military man who decided that the military life was not conducive to awakening. And so even though he was very successful in his job as a soldier and a general even, he gave it up and took vows and entered the monastic community under Obai. And so he says to the other monks, look, you know, I'm the military man around here. If anybody can find that, you know, that scoundrel, that, you know, guy in the kitchen who's stolen the robe and the bowl from Obai, it's me. I'm an expert tracker. I can hike for days, you know. So they said, you're right. You're the guy to do this. So Myo sets out looking for what he thinks is the thief who has taken the robe and the bowl from Obai, which is why they assume Obai didn't give it to Shen Xie, the obvious winner of the contest. So Monk Myo track, he is just what he says. He's a really good tracker. He knows the woods. He follows Wei Nang's trail until he gets to Wei Nang's encampment. And that's where this scene takes place. So Wei Nang, you could imagine, is washing his face. You know, he's leaned over like a pond, or by a running stream. And he's drinking some water with his hands, and he's washing his face. And, you know, you can see over the crest is the general, is this monk general, Myo, coming down the hill to grab the robe and the bowl from this scoundrel who's taken them. And in the story, in this koan, basically, he tries to lift them up, and he can't lift them up. And he has like a little nervous breakdown. He tries to pick them up, but they won't budge. He tried to move it, but he was as heavy as a mountain. Then he starts trembling. It's like, what the hell? He says, I came for the Dharma, not the robe. I beg you, please give me instruction. So, you know, this koan has several parts. But it's pretty clear that Monk Myo came for the robe and the bowl, right? He can't, you know, one way to understand this koan is that Myo and all the monks in the community were obsessed with the robe and the bowl, right? They were obsessed with these symbols of authority or symbols of enlightenment. You know, the koan is telling you not to be attached to these symbols of enlightenment, right? Who cares about the robe and the bowl? Who cares? What really matters is the Dharma, is the teaching. See, he says, I came for the Dharma. I see now that I shouldn't be coming for the robe and the bowl. What really matters is the Dharma. And he says, I realize that you are not a normal person. You know, you may look and act and be an ignorant woodcutter, but you're obviously not a normal person. He says, can you please teach me? What is it that you know that Obai found so important? Wei Nang says, think neither good nor evil. See, think neither good nor evil. That's the core of this little story. Now, you know, if you take these words at face value, think neither good nor evil, it's bound to be a little puzzling, right? What we want to say is that you should think good things and avoid evil things, right? And for Wei Nang to say think neither good nor evil sounds like a very strange thing for Buddhism to teach. right? And this koan is often misunderstood. You know, people often say, well, you know, good and evil are both relative. They have no importance. You know, Zen doesn't really care about good or evil, you know. But that would be quite a misunderstanding. You know, when I first started practicing Zen, you know, I was a pretty unhappy person. And when I first met my teacher, Genki Roshi, I was definitely impressed. You know, this person seemed to be happy in a really deep way. You know, I actually fell in love with my Zen teacher. You know, he was such a remarkable person. He was a unfailingly kind and gentle human being who always seemed at ease under any circumstances or almost any circumstances. And he seemed to me to be the opposite of what I was like, you know. I would have described myself as sort of somewhat depressed a lot of the time when I was younger, in my early 20s. And I was very anxious a lot of the time and fearful, you know. And when I met Genki Roshi, I sort of unconsciously felt the presence of this person who had a very different way of being in the world, you know. And so I wanted to be like him. You know, I wanted to be like Genki Roshi. So, you know, I started doing Zazen with him. And I felt better after just a couple weeks of Zazen. You know, I probably had an anxiety disorder of some kind, and that was making me depressed. And when I started to do Zazen, I just felt so much better. And you know, at first I would come to the university where we had meditation at the University of Washington on a Wednesday night. And we would do three sits, and then I would go out with my friends who came with me, and we'd all have a big beer and undo all the good effects of the meditation. And I'd get up next day sort of groggy from having a big glass of beer. So, you know, eventually I stopped drinking a big glass of beer after my Wednesday night sit, and I started coming more often, more regularly. And it really did wonders for me. It really changed my life. And I've been doing it for 40 years because it was so powerful. But, you know, one of my obstacles was wanting to be enlightened, you know, wanting to be like Genki Roshi, you know. When I first started doing Zazen, it really helped me, you know. So I would sit down on the cushion and I would watch my breath, and I had lots of struggles. I mean, first of all, the physical aspect of meditation was very difficult for me. You know, I used to run track in high school, and I am a very athletic person. I was at that time quite an avid hiker, and you know, I would ride a bicycle. I thought nothing of riding my bike like 30 miles in a day, you know, that kind of thing. And my muscles were very tight and inflexible, and sitting on the cushion was a real challenge for me. Sometimes 20 minutes into the sit, I would be covered with sweat, you know. So it was physically challenging and it was mentally challenging. And, you know, getting through to it, the first time I ever did three 25-minute sits, it was so diff. I could barely make it through the third one. But after a couple months, it began to get much easier, and I began to feel much better. But then, you know, I kind of spoiled it. I sort of spoiled it. Like, maybe 6 months into my Zen training, everything was going very well, but I sort of spoiled it. Because I began to have an idea of what should be happening on the cushion. I began to sort of like set a high standard for myself. You know? I did have sits where I would come in and I would sit down and I would feel so much better. And I had some sits where I would actually sort of like enter deep samadhi. I didn't know it was deep samadhi, but I would have some sits where I was really like in this very beautiful state. You know, I would just sort of like blissful. If you haven't had that experience, please keep practicing because you definitely will. And I would have these beautiful experiences, blissful experiences. But then, you know, sometimes I would come in and I would sit down and I would feel unhappy with my practice. Because a lot of the time I would just sit down on the cushion and nothing seemed to be happening, you know. And sometimes I would spend the whole 20, you know, the whole meditation period, you know, still sort of churning in my anxieties. In fact, in some ways, I even think my anxieties became more obvious to me. You know, one night after meditating here, in this room, we have evening meditation, as you know. There was a guy who had been coming for about 6 months, and then he quit coming, and then he came back sort of sporadically, and then he disappeared altogether. But I overheard, you know, him talking to somebody who had just come, had just been starting to sit for like a month or two. And they didn't realize I was sort of listening, and I wasn't intentionally sort of eavesdropping. But I definitely heard what he said, and the guy who had been coming for a while and then stopped coming, he said, "Yeah, Zen helps at first, but then it stops helping you, and it's actually worse." So I decided not to intervene in that conversation. But I understand exactly what he meant. You know, at first, you know, when you begin to do Zazen, you don't have any expectations. You just come in, you sit down on the cushion, and because you have no expectations, you know, anything can happen. You know, anything can happen. You know, we call that, Zen calls that beginner's mind. You know, when you have beginner's mind, you sit, you come to sit, you straighten the back, breathe from your abdominal region, which is sort of weird, right? And at the end of 25 minutes, you get off the cushion, you say, "You know, I actually do feel better." You know, and you start meditating that way, and without any expectations, things just start happening that are positive. You know, you'll notice after a couple of weeks of meditation, you begin to feel a lot better. And if people could just practice with that mind forever, it would be great. You know, it'd be wonderful. You could do anything. But you know, it's hard for us to preserve that beginner's mind because we begin to form like standards for our performance, and we begin to compare ourselves to others, right? And we begin to fantasize about the enlightened state, right? You know, so if you do that long enough, you begin to become dissatisfied with your practice, and you begin to sort of like make it much harder than it has to be. And in fact, you can take the joy out of the practice. You know, when you didn't know what you were doing, it was so effective. But if you begin to set standards for yourself, you know, if you begin to imagine that, you know, there's such a thing as enlightened consciousness, and then you begin to pursue that actively as a goal, it actually has the effect of making your practice, it can have the effect of making your practice unhappy and frustrating. So something that begins as profoundly liberating can become profoundly you can reach a point where you just don't want to sit anymore. I've actually had people say that, you know, "I just feel like every sit is a defeat." It's a defeat. What do you mean? "Well, I'm not enlightened yet." See? So that's a common you know, "I've been practicing for 10 years and I still haven't had enlightenment." It's like, "Well, yeah, but how do you feel, you know, when you get off the cushion, how do you feel?" "Great." "What's the problem?" See, this is so human, right? You know, the problem is, you know, even more complicated than that. You know, Zen mind is a mind that doesn't grasp at anything. This is hard for us, right? Normally, all day long, we're grasping at something. We're trying, you know, even if you just get up in the morning and you want breakfast, you know, you start grasping. You know, this is an old word in Buddhist discourse, grasping. You know, when I get up in the morning, I do it too. I think, you know, I get up and I sit, and then I think, oh boy, what'll I have for breakfast? And I start thinking about, what would I like for breakfast, right? And then I'll go and, you know, you go to the cupboard and there's no damn oatmeal. Right? It's like, God damn it, you know. And so what's left, you know, yogurt, okay, I'll have some yogurt, you know, and then it's off to work. So it's this grasping consciousness, right? You go for something and then you're frustrated because it's not... you know, there have been times in my life where having yogurt in the refrigerator would have been like the heavens opening up. You know, at one time, my wife and I, when we were poor students, we had $17 in the bank, right? And we didn't get to the bank, and this was before cash. There was a time, you won't believe this, but there was actually a time when there were no cash machines, right? You know, the way you got money was to cash a check. There used to be something called a check. And you wrote your name on it, it was a piece of paper, and you took it to, if you took it to the grocery store, you had to buy something, right, in order to get the difference. And otherwise, you'd have to go to a bank and give them the check, and they'd give you the cash. So we were both working summer jobs. My wife was a waitress, and I was working for the Mayflower Moving Company. And we didn't get to the bank in time. So it's like we had no, you know, I remember we went to the, what's up in the cupboard? You know, we had like a couple cans of beans, you know, this and that. It's like, we'll be okay. You know, we'll have beans and rice every day until Monday, and then we can get some money, you know. So there were times in my life where, you know, if I had gone to the refrigerator and it's like, yogurt, really? It would have been, this is ambrosia. You know, this is nectar. But now, you know, only yogurt, see. So this is the discriminate. This is what we call in Zen the discriminating mind, right? You know, we live with many preferences, right? Many preferences, and we can make this discriminating mind that's grasping can also poison our Zen practice, which can be so liberating. Because, you know, when people start doing Zen, they stop grasping because they don't know what they should be grasping for. And so they experience this great openness, right? This great openness. You know, I just sat on the cushion and all of a sudden, you know, I was watching my breath and my breath disappeared and my mind went blank. Isn't that the darndest thing? You know, you might say, I don't know why I feel happy, but I feel happy right now. You know, but then if the next time you come in and you sit, you think, okay, you know, now I'm going to sit on the cushion, watch my breath, my mind is going to be blank. But then, you know, your mind doesn't go blank. And you can get really upset with that. You know, you could feel like, well, this isn't working out. You know, this happens all the time. You know, people will come to Sesshin, and on day three of Sesshin, you know, everything seems so beautiful. If you haven't gone to Sesshin, let me beg you to go to Sesshin. You know, you will never regret it for as long as you live. And on day three of Sesshin, you know, after a couple of days of challenging sitting, you know, there's like a little switch that goes on in people's heads, and everything seems so beautiful and alive. You know, but you know, maybe by day five of Sesshin, you know, you're getting a little tired, and you know, everything's not quite as beautiful, and you can feel like, oh, it's slipping away. See, and this is a little game we play with ourselves, right? Or people will have a wonderful sit, and they'll come in to see me in Dokusan at Sesshin and say, oh, that was amazing, you know, and the next day they come to Dokusan, how's your practice? Oh, not so good. What do you mean? Well, you know, that didn't happen again, right? This is the grasping mentality. So, if we're not careful, we can take this incredibly liberating practice of Zen and make it a source of unhappiness by setting some kind of goal or standard. You know, you could say, well, an enlightened person wouldn't be feeling these feelings right now, wouldn't be feeling anxiety. How do you know? You know, maybe an enlightened person would feel anxiety. But, you know, the thing is, if you feel anxiety, sit with your anxiety. You know, if you just pay attention to your anxiety, it kind of just disappears like clouds floating past in the sky. You know, we have, in Zen, we practice what is called a nowhere-dwelling mind, a mind that clings to nothing. This is the secret to Zen. The mind that clings to nothing. This is the secret. See, you know, we learn it the hard way, and usually we have to learn it the hard way. So if the teacher gives you a koan, you want to, quote, answer the koan. And, you know, you might try to think through the koan, you know. Maybe the koan is, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. Maybe that's the koan. So you go back to your cushion and you think, okay, now let me see now. How's that possible, right? You know, if I have a staff, he'll give me one. If I have no staff, he'll take it away. So he's saying, don't be attached, right? That's it. You know, I try to figure it out. And then you go on to see the teacher. The teacher says, no, it has nothing to do with that. So, you know, we're trying and trying and trying to achieve a goal. And, you know, in the process, we go through, like, you know, like the stages of death or something. You know, there's these five stages of death, you know, denial, anger, something, and finally acceptance, right? You know, you kind of go through that on the cushion, you know. And in the last stage, it's like, screw it. You know, I don't really care if I answer this koan or not. And usually that's when people have some deep insight. See? It's like letting go. So important. You know, so in this case, you know, the robe and the bowl are like symbols of some kind of attainment. And Monk Myo, like all the monks, you know, they're so fixated on this thing called enlightenment, you know. And even Shensyu says, you know, keep the dust off your mirror. He's right in a certain sense. If you don't practice Zazen, nothing is going to happen. And in a certain sense, he's right. By the way, Shensyu went on to be a very great Zen master. And so did Wei Neng. They both had like different aspects of practice. They understood different aspects of practice. One aspect of practice is regularity and discipline. If you don't practice regularly, nothing happens. But when you sit down on the cushion, you have to let go. Whatever arises is okay. See, whatever in my hippie days, we used to say going with the flow. See, but actually going with the flow is great wisdom. See, you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and then you have to be open to what's happening. And it's never going to be what you expect. It's what you have a deeper mind. You have a bigger mind. It's bigger than your conscious mind. In Zen, we call this your Buddha mind. You have a deeper mind, and that deeper mind is the master. I'm the coach. That deeper mind is the teacher. See, I'm just the coach. But that deeper mind is your teacher. Being open to the teacher's lessons requires from you having no expectations for or against anything. So as long as you sit down on the cushion with like a plan or a goal, you can't hear your teacher's voice. Your teacher has a lesson ready for you. You have to just be willing to be present with it. Let it unfold. And sometimes the teacher, your great Buddha mind, wants you to see something that causes you frustration so that you can recognize it and leave it behind. So not all your sits are blissful sits. Sometimes the teacher, the master, wants you to see something you don't want to see. And we say, I don't want to see this, I don't want to see this, I don't. But eventually you give up and you see it, and then it ceases to be an obstacle. So Bunk Myo misunderstood the nature of practice. And we misunderstand the nature of Zen if we think, think neither good nor evil means throw ethical standards out the window. It's not about that. It's about not passing judgment on what happens as you move forward in your life. It's about being open and grateful and attentive to every moment of your life without judgment. Without judgment. See, that's how to practice on the cushion and how to practice off the cushion. And because it's hard for us, we need to practice on the cushion a lot.
The sixth ancestor was pursued by Monk Myo as far as Tai Yu Mountain. The ancestor, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "The robe represents the faith. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it away, take it now." See, he doesn't care. I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter. Myo tried to move it, but it was heavy as a mountain. So he's made an obstacle out of this, see, by clinging, by trying to get a certain result. Faltering and trembling, he cried out, okay, I see. I should be coming for the Dharma, not the robe. I beg you, tell me where I'm going wrong." The ancestor said, "Think, when you sit down on the cushion, think neither good nor evil. Just be open to what's happening. Without judgment. At this very moment, what is the original self of Monk Myo?" And Myo looks into his mind and he realizes that at the core of our consciousness there is this radiant, non-judgmental awareness. Right? That we mess up, we screw up, because we don't pay attention to the freedom inside ourselves. At these words, Myo was directly illuminated. His whole body was covered with sweat. He wept and he bowed and he said, "Besides the secret words and secret meaning you have just revealed to me by pointing to that radiant, non-judgmental mind at the core of my awareness, is there anything else deeper still?" The ancestor said, "It's not a secret. It's right there. When you look into your own true self, whatever is deeper is found right there." Myo said, I was with the monks under Obi for many years and I didn't realize this. But now, receiving your instruction, it is like a person drinking water for himself instead of hearing water described. When you taste the water, you know it's cold or it's hot. You know for yourself. He says, "My lay brother, I now call you my teacher." The ancestor said, "Okay, you can call me teacher if you want, but let's both call Obi our teacher." So try to live in this non-judgmental mind. Mumon's comment. The sixth ancestor was, so to speak, hurried into helping a man in an emergency, and he displayed a grandmotherly kindness. This is such an important term in Buddhism, grandmotherly kindness. It is as though he peeled a fresh lychee, removed the seed, put it in your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. Mumon's verse. You can't describe it. You cannot picture it, that luminous, radiant core of your awareness. You cannot admire it. Don't try to eat it raw. Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed.